gives me great pleasure to introduce to you today our opening ceremony speaker, Dr. Francis Collins. Dr. Collins is the current director of the National Institutes of Health, where he oversees 27 institutes with a current annual budget of $37 billion, making this the largest biotechnology institution in the world. Dr. Collins received his Bachelor of Sciences from the University of Virginia, his PhD from Yale University, and his medical degree from the University of North Carolina, where he also completed his residency in internal medicine. He then went back to Yale University, where he basically went on to do a fellowship in medical genetics, and then was recruited by the University of Michigan to become a faculty member there. And it was at the University of Michigan where he led breakthrough research that led to faster gene sequencing by a technology named chromosome jumping. This technology allowed Dr. Collins to work on identifying many genes, including those for Huntington's and cystic fibrosis. For this work, he was nicknamed the Gene Hunter. He was then recruited to run the Human Genome Research Institute at the National Institutes of Health, where he led the Human Genome Project. And in 2003, he announced that for the very first time, a human composite gene was fully sequenced, leading to many discoveries that we have today. He was thereafter recruited to his current position, leading the NIH, a job that he is now in his 10th year and has been leading very well. He's actually, in fact, the only appointee left over from the prior administration in this administration still working in Washington, D.C. His work has been recognized by many avenues and agencies, including by his election to the Institute of Medicine, now the National Academy of Sciences, as well as the National Academy of Medicine. He has received the highest award in the area of science administered by a National Science Foundation when he received the National Medal of Science. And he has received the highest award, civilian award, bestowed by a president, the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Please help me in welcoming today our 2018 American College of Surgeons Martin Memorial Lecturer, a researcher, physician, leader, and pioneer, Dr. Francis Collins.
Thank you, Dr. Atala, my friend. To the distinguished panel members of the platform here assembled on the stage, Dr. Mayer, Dr. Hoyt, ladies and gentlemen, it is a privilege and an honor to be asked to give a lecture of this sort with many distinguished individuals who have preceded me on that list, if you've seen it, of who has been asked over these many years to deliver the Franklin Martin Memorial Lecture. And I take it with some seriousness and hope to present to you some things from my perspective as the NIH Director of Research that I think has high degree of relevance to your field of surgery. It will be a little bit of a potpourri because across the broad landscape of medical research, there are so many things that I might have chosen to touch on. But given the time limits, I will try to be respectful of the rest of your program and choose a few things for your attention and hope to stimulate your interest. NIH is the largest supporter of biomedical research in the world. Part of our effort is basic science, pursuit of fundamental knowledge about the nature and behavior of living systems. But the other part is the application, which goes to clinical trials, to implementation research, to things which have significant impact on your field of surgery. We conduct research in our own laboratories in Bethesda. That's the intramural program. But the vast majority of our budget goes out to those institutions across the country and many outside the country that support the best research, all judged by peer review. We help train research investigators. We foster communication of medical information. And we're pretty good at it, at least judged by the outputs that have been recorded over the years. As of this fall, 156 of those we have supported to do their research have become Nobel laureates, including a number of them just this past month. Our current appropriation of $39 billion is a remarkable testimony to the confidence that the Congress has in this engine of discovery. And, of course, these are taxpayers' dollars, and we take that with great seriousness. We have a very clear strategic plan about how we set priorities for where those dollars should go. But much of what we do is driven by the insights and the creativity of investigators who come to us with their best and brightest ideas, and we seek to put those through a peer review system that's the most rigorous in the world, and then to fund the best ideas that are there. If you look at the trajectory of the support of NIH, and this is in constant dollars, you'll see it has not exactly been a totally smooth trajectory. We had a lovely doubling of NIH that happened between 1998 and 2003, as you can sort of see in that lovely slope there. And then we underwent what was an unfortunate 15-year slide, during which we lost about 20% of our purchasing power. I'm very happy to point out that in the last 4 years, we have seen, thanks to Congress seeing the value of this, even in a difficult budgetary time, the opportunity to see that curve start upward again. And we have now, 4 years in a row, seen significant increases in the NIH budget, including just this month for fiscal year 19, where another $2 billion has been added to our resources. We take that with great seriousness. The highest priority we have right now is to fund early-stage investigators, our next generation of future talent. And this past year, we funded the largest number of those investigators ever, and that will be our goal this year as well. So if there are young scientists, surgeons in the room, I would say this is a really good time to be engaged in medical research. The scientific opportunities, and I'll touch on a few of them, are really remarkable, and the support for that scientific research effort is also looking much brighter than it was 4 or 5 years ago. We do, as I say, have an intramural program in Bethesda, and it includes the world's largest research hospital, the clinical center, which we are fond of calling the House of Hope. People come to this clinical center because pretty much every other option has not turned out to work for them. Nobody comes to this hospital unless they're on a research protocol. Many of them with cancer or infectious diseases or diabetes or kidney problems, where basically the current status of medicine is not able to come up with answers. In that particular hospital, you will find patients of all sorts, many of them self-referred by finding out about this through clinicaltrials.gov, which is the main site where people find out about clinical trials of all sorts, but certainly points to this. One of our physicians, surgeons, spoke to you in the Martin Lecture just 3 or 4 years ago, Marston Linehan, who's the head of urological surgery, about his work there as a practicing surgeon who's also come up with strategies to treat kidney cancer that are pretty breathtaking. There are 1,500 clinical studies in progress there, and this clinical center was actually honored by receipt of the Lasker Bloomberg Public Service Award a few years ago. And if you didn't see it, if you want to have something to show to people that shows what it's like to be involved in clinical research, a rather gritty documentary with 6 hours in the Discovery Channel following four families who came to the NIH, each of them in a circumstance of some desperation, enrolling in clinical trials. And not all of the outcomes were what one would hope for. It's quite real. But some remarkable saving experiences happening there as well. So in touching on NIH and why I'm fond of calling it not just the National Institutes of Health, but also the National Institutes of Hope, I thought I'd touch on three major topics and give you a little snapshot of what's going on. First of all, uncovering life's foundations, the basic science part of what we do. My friend Dr. Atala already mentioned the Human Genome Project, something that I was deeply honored to have the chance to lead, and which in 2003 did result in pointing to the Human Genome Instruction Book in a public database that has been a wonderful activator of much research since that time. Graduate students today hardly imagine how you did anything in studying human biology without having the human genome right there at the click of a mouse, and it is. And of course, that was the first reference sequence. Took us 13 years to get it. Cost about $400 million. We needed lots more of those because we wanted to understand variation between individuals, and we needed to understand how the genome actually functions. This remarkable instruction book with just four letters in its alphabet, how does it work? And how do we apply that information then at the bedside to try to advance the cause of clinical medicine? Well, we added to that a whole host of other projects that NIH has supported since 2003, which have decorated the human genome with a lot of really exciting information about genomics, about proteomics, about epigenomics, how it is that genes turn on or off in the appropriate tissue, or how sometimes that goes awry in disease results. So there's a vast amount of this kind of information, all made immediately publicly accessible, which is also one of the ethical strategies that we've adopted for the field of genomics, that this information is too important to hide it away somewhere, and also that it is not appropriate to patent things which really ought to be the shared inheritance of all of us. Meanwhile, the cost of sequencing a human genome, which I mentioned, that first one cost about $400 million, and even in 2001, if you'd started over again, it would have been $100 million to do that. Look and see what's happened here. That's a log scale on the y-axis, and here we are now at this point where we've gone from $100 million per genome to about 850. That's today's number. And it's on the way further down. We'll be to the $100 genome pretty soon. And what used to take years can now be done in about 2 days. So the idea that each of us could have our complete genomes determined, placed in our medical record, available for use when a decision needs to be made about a preventive strategy or a therapeutic strategy is very much upon us, although for most of us it hasn't quite happened yet. It's going to. This has empowered a vast array of other kinds of activities. And first, I should point out, particularly so, that has been in the case of cancer. Cancer is a disease of the genome. It comes about because of misspellings in DNA, some that are inherited, like a BRCA1 mutation, most of which happen during life as a result of either some exposure to a carcinogen or perhaps just a stochastic error that a cell makes as it's trying to copy this very large instruction book. And so it was very clear, as genome sequencing got more and more affordable, that we should apply this to cancer. And the Cancer Genome Atlas was identified as a strategy now 11 years ago. Where we are now with that is pretty breathtaking. That has now resulted in the sequencing of 11,000 cancers to be able to say, what is there driving those good cells to go bad? 7 different data types from those cancers, 33 different tumor types. Again, all of this accessible in public databases, all 2.5 petabytes of information. And what we've learned there is that there are pathways that are involved in cancer that are common, but that each individual tumor tends to have a different kind of mutational spectrum that has led that particular cancer to happen. Which is to say that if you want to choose the therapeutic for that individual, a one-size-fits-all approach may not be the right answer. The discovery of the mutations in so many cancers has also led to many advances in identifying new drug targets. And if I had cancer today, I would want to have my tumor immediately sequenced. I'd want to see which pathways are in fact responsible, and I'd want to have the choice of therapeutics based upon that information, as opposed to an older-fashioned way of doing things where everybody got the same kind of chemotherapy for the same stage of tumor in the same organ. It's becoming less important what organ the cancer arises in than what mutations in which genes are present in that particular cancer. That is much more significant oftentimes in terms of the choice of therapy. All of this information can, in fact, be found in this pan-cancer atlas, and certainly oncologists are using this all the time to try to guide decision-making about what treatment should be offered to which patients. That was basic science, but of course it moves immediately into how do we translate this into patient care. So continuing with the cancer theme, the cancer moonshot, which was very much an effort advocated by former Vice President Joe Biden and adopted by the Congress and now funded over the course of 10 years, aims to accelerate the advances that are now possible in cancer into patient care by accelerating clinical trials for some of these new therapeutics, enhancing data sharing so we learn as much as we possibly can from the whole country's experience, and a partnership with industry to accelerate cancer therapeutics, particularly focused on immunotherapy. This whole idea of being able to optimize treatment based on the specific molecular signature in an individual cancer is being tested in a trial called MATCH, which aims to try to see with people who enroll in this, and this particular trial enrolled in record time because patients were intensely interested, what is, in fact, the benefit of having that information? Does it change outcomes? Answers early on are yes, not for everybody, but for a substantial fraction of those who enroll in the trial. Having that information about the specific tumor mutations leading to a choice about therapeutics has improved outcome. Cancer immunotherapy is one of the hottest areas of science across all of medicine right now. Some individuals like Steve Rosenberg, who's the head of surgery at the National Cancer Institute, have labored in this field for decades and were often sneered at as wasting their time because most of the strategies that he and others tried to adopt to activate the immune system to go after a cancer didn't work. But occasionally they would. And now, look what's happened over the course of the last 10 years with the discovery that, in fact, the immune system is capable of going after cancer cells, but oftentimes the cancer is pretty clever in disguising itself, convincing the immune system that there's nothing to see here. With the development of checkpoint inhibitors, that has changed for many patients in dramatic ways. Think Jimmy Carter, who 3 years ago announced he had metastatic melanoma to his brain, and who is now working in his usual way for Habitat for Humanity, apparently cured by the administration of one of these checkpoint inhibitors. Cancer immunotherapy being recognized now by the awarding of various prizes. I mentioned Steve Rosenberg a minute ago. He, Jim Allison, and Carl June are receiving the Albany Medical Center Prize a month ago. And the Nobel going to Jim Allison and Tetsuko Hanjo for their development of checkpoint inhibitors. This is a really dramatic change in our ability to treat cancer. We've always had surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy. Now we have a fourth modality, immunotherapy. And for many patients, this deserves close consideration and can, in fact, be remarkably life-saving, even for patients with metastatic disease, for whom not just remissions but cures seem to be happening, primarily now for lymphomas, leukemias, melanomas, some cases of lung cancer, some cases of kidney cancer. The big challenge now is to get this to work for those solid tumors like colon and pancreas, prostate, breast, and glioblastoma, for which we still don't have the kind of responses to immunotherapy that we hope for. But I will predict those are going to come with some of the new strategies that are being adopted that take full advantage of everything we can learn about a tumor and everything we can learn about the immune system and how to take the immune system to school, maybe even to graduate school, to teach it what it should be looking for in those cancer neoantigens that are there but have somehow been disguised. Another interesting thing to report to you related to cancer, and I think this got some attention last summer, but I'm not sure everybody heard about it. This relates to breast cancer, and particularly to women who have hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative, node negative breast cancer, the most common form of early stage breast cancer. And there's this long-term debate about should those women undergo adjuvant chemotherapy or not. We know that as a group, there is a benefit to adjuvant chemotherapy, but we also know that most of those women are already cured by surgery and radiation, and don't benefit at all from the chemotherapy. And, of course, it is rigorous and toxic to go through. Wouldn't it be nice to know which women actually need the additional chemotherapy and which ones can safely forego it? Well, here's again a chance to utilize tools of genomics to look at the nature of a particular breast cancer and see if we could learn the signature of those cancers that are already likely to be cured and those which are the bad actors that still need chemotherapy as a follow-up to the original treatment. That is something that's now been investigated extensively for more than 10 years. A long-term study was done, supported by the National Cancer Institute and also by the breast cancer stamp, that tested one of those genomic tests called Oncotype DX. It gives you a score about whether recurrence is likely, based upon which genes are on or off in that breast cancer. We knew already that in a low score situation, recurrence was unlikely. And a high score it was, but many patients were in the middle, and those individuals were continuing to receive adjuvant chemotherapy, as you probably would do if it was yourself or your loved one, because you didn't want to take the chance of missing the benefit. But we already knew that most of the patients in that middle group probably wouldn't benefit. So the recent study called TAILOR-X, Trial Assigning Individualized Options for Treatment, was a 10-year study, more than 10,000 women after surgery, and 69% of them were in that mid-range score. And it turned out that, in fact, the vast majority of those did just as well with no chemotherapy at all, just hormone therapy alone. Published in the New England Journal, information here about this. This is also a moment for me to advertise the NIH director's blog, which you could read every Tuesday and Thursday, where I try to write about something exciting that's happened in medical research. And this was pretty exciting, because that is a very large number of women who now, with this test engaged, need not go through the experience of chemotherapy. This also, by our calculation, will save our medical care system in the United States about $1.5 billion each year by not having to administer chemotherapy to those who are not going to benefit from it. So it's a really good example of how these sorts of advances do allow you to make personalized choices, precision medicine, as we call it, and also choices that save money. Another couple of things I might just mention that I thought would be of relevance to this audience in terms of clinical applications. Some of these still very much in the development stage, but there are, in fact, ways, both administering substances intravenously or even topically, to aid the surgeon when one is in the midst of a complicated operation and trying to preserve normal tissue. One is an effort to try to improve the ability to identify where the margins are of a tumor. And again, there are various fluorophore approaches to this that are starting to look pretty promising. Another effort by the same group has also come up with topically applied or intravenously applied fluorescent markers that allow nerves to be more visible at a time where one is carrying out a surgical procedure and you want not to mistakenly clip that nerve. That kind of thing is finding its way increasingly into the OR, and is certainly something I thought this audience might want to track. Much of this still on the research phase, but it's coming. I have to say something about regenerative medicine. Tony Atala, who introduced me, spoke to you 7 years ago as the Martin Memorial Lecturer. And Tony, of all the people I know, is one of those who has pushed forward this whole field of regenerative medicine most effectively. And it is exciting to see the way in which we are learning how to adopt a lot of the things that are coming out of basic science and bring them forward for clinical applications. One is this, the ability to take a skin biopsy from any person and, by the appropriate administration of just 4 different genes, convince those skin cells to go back in time and become pluripotent, induced pluripotent stem cells. They basically have the potential then to become any kind of cell type. And they also tend to be, at that point, stable and immortal. So if you wanted to make a substitute bunch of cells or even a whole organ for somebody who needs one, maybe their skin cells are just waiting there to be asked to help. And with the appropriate manipulations, we could get there. And you can take those induced pluripotent stem cells and differentiate them into heart muscle or into nerves, into pancreatic beta cells, into a wide variety of things that you can imagine could have considerable clinical application. We've also been using them to build tissue chips from an individual. where you make small clusters of these cells, organoids we sometimes call them, three-dimensional structures, from a single individual. You can make an organoid that represents kidney, and another that's heart, and another that is neurons, and another that is muscle, and another is liver, and so on, and put all of those on a biochip, and then utilize that as a means to assess whether a particular intervention you're contemplating might be beneficial or toxic for that person. There's a real possibility this same approach may lead to the identification of a pathway to make an artificial pancreas for individuals whose pancreas is no longer functioning, as for instance with type 1 diabetes. And may I even allow production of entire transplantable organs? Well, that is clearly several years downstream. But look at some of what's happened here as a result of this research. If you see in the upper right there, that is an organoid that actually is made of heart muscle and something that looks a lot like a pericardium. That has been generated from what was originally a skin cell, put through this process of becoming an iPSC, and then differentiated with appropriate cocktails into forming this structure. At this point, microscopic, but you can see where this might be going. Now, other examples like that on this same slide. And we are going to see over the course of the next decade, I think, dramatic advances in that space. And goodness knows, we need them. I could show you other slides of how people are already using iPS cells to generate kidney tissue that is actually capable of making urine. I've seen some of these chips as well. Again, on a very small scale. But think about where this could go. I have to go to another topic now because it's one that's much on my mind, and I will be at the White House on Wednesday with the President in an effort to further spread the word about how critical it is for us as a nation to focus on this crisis of addiction to opioids, and as well as the crisis of pain in the United States. We now have more than 2 million Americans that are addicted to opioids, and I'm sad to say as a physician that most of those started with prescriptions written by physicians at a time 20 years ago where we mistakenly believed that people who actually were in pain could not become addicted to opioids. That was categorically wrong. It still troubles me to see how oftentimes individuals who come in for a broken bone or perhaps an oral surgical procedure are given prescriptions of a month's worth of something that is likely to become addicting, and they can in fact fall into that trap. Those 2 million Americans have now had their brains rewired. If you want to call opioid addiction a matter of just free will, look at the data to show you that the brain has actually been biologically altered in a way that is visible on various scans by the exposure to opioids over time. And the data is very compelling that nobody will be able to recover from that simply because they want to. Medication-assisted treatment is really the only proven way to assist in people recovering from addiction, and that is still very difficult indeed. So we have a crisis of major proportions, particularly in certain areas of the country, as you can see from the map. And the deaths from opioids are troubling in a massive way. We are losing more people than we lost to HIV/AIDS at the peak of the epidemic in the late 1980s, early 1990s. We are losing more people to deaths from opioids than in traffic accidents. And we have not seen the leveling off yet of this gradual rise year after year of more and more of these accidental deaths, especially now that many of those who became addicted originally to prescription pills, as the pills were harder to get, and as heroin became cheaper, shifted over to heroin, which is now often laced with fentanyl, which is incredibly potent and is the main source now of overdose deaths. I hope all of you aware of this, or maybe even contemplating keeping as part of your own apparatus for emergency intervention the nasal inhaled version of Narcan, naloxone, which is capable of reversing an overdose. The Surgeon General of the United States, Jerome Adams, is advocating that if one is interested in being able to save people in an emergency, if you're learning CPR, you should also carry naloxone. I carry it. But we must also remember that this is not just about dealing with addiction that happens for no reason. We have people in America, 25 million of them, who have daily pain. The problem has been that opioids are a terrible way to treat daily chronic pain, and yet there has not really been other alternatives available. At the same time, research has revolutionized our understanding both of pathways involved in addiction and of new ways that we might approach pain by all of the targets that are emerging from neuroscience that have not yet led to therapeutics, but they could. And so there's a great motivation now, and this is between academia and industry, working together with NIH support to try to accelerate the development of non-addictive but potent pain medicines so that we would have other alternatives than opioids who are killing all these people. Again, I think all of us as physicians have to take some responsibility for how we got here. The CDC has been very clear about putting forward guidelines about what should be happening now in terms of prescribing of opioids, and certainly that applies to instances that involve surgical procedures. I hope all of you are familiar with some of those recommendations, and if not, can get access to them. I still hear disturbing stories of people who, after a surgical procedure that might require a day or two of pain medicines, are walking away with a month's supply of oxycodone, and who knows what happens there, and oftentimes it's not good. These are dangerous drugs. What are we doing at NIH? Well, thanks to the Congress providing us an additional $500 million a year, which just happened a few months ago, we've set up an initiative called HEAL, which stands for Helping to End Addiction Long Term. It means that we can improve prevention and treatment strategies. We can enhance pain management by coming up with new therapeutics and testing them in a clinical trial. We can work with the Surgeon General and other forces to make this a collaborative effort. If you want to read more about it, it's on our NIH.gov website. One of the things we are doing is to develop new treatments for opioid addiction. Right now, there are three medications, methadone, buprenorphine, naltrexone. They're not available in as many different kinds of formulations as you would ideally like to see, and so we are pushing that forward. If imagine if you had an injectable form of buprenorphine that lasted for 6 months as opposed to having people have to take this once a day, I think the chance of relapse, which is very common in addiction, would be reduced if we had that kind of effort, and that's underway. We need to do something about the terribly sad story of those thousands of babies that are being born every month whose mothers were on opioids, and therefore they are born going through a terrible withdrawal experience, and we don't even quite know what that does to fetal development of the brain. We need to strengthen this clinical trials network, build links with the emergency departments, work with the justice system, because an awful lot of individuals who end up addicted also in desperation end up in trouble with the law trying to get access to drugs. And then being in the criminal justice system is an opportunity to get that turned around, but it is often not the case that that happens. And then we have a healing communities study for which we're seeking applicants right now, where we're going to try in two or three places in the country to bring together all of the entities that should be able to help here but haven't really been integrated. The emergency rooms, the primary care docs, the social work system, the state health department, the faith-based organizations, the criminal justice system, all of that together in a carefully researched environment to try to figure out what works. And we're going to hold those accountable for drastically reducing the death rate from opioids over the course of a couple of years. And if we find out what works, then extrapolate that to the whole nation. In terms of pain management, we have to come up with better strategies than what we have. We need to understand, and I imagine that would be of great interest to this audience, what happens in that transition from acute to chronic pain. If somebody's had a knee replacement, most people get over that and do fine, but you all know there's a subset of individuals who end up with chronic pain. What is that about, and how do we prevent that transition from happening? We need new and better treatments for pain that are not addictive, and so working with industry, finding new small molecules and biologicals and devices, we aim to accelerate that process. So that's a particularly important part of our agenda. Let me move to the last point, however, and talk about a truly ambitious project that's just now getting underway that you may not have heard about, which I think is going to be transformative for everything we do in medical care in the future. And that's, again, focused on this idea of precision medicine. So what do I mean by that? I think we all recognize as physicians that most of the time in a patient encounter, you are building on data that's out there, but it's often data that is one size fits all. It's kind of what we can do. It's the best we know. But we all know that patients are different, and we try to optimize our choices as a result of that, but often don't really have the evidence to know how to do that. This means precision is needed, which means that tailoring medical care to unique individuals would be a good thing if we had the really solid data to do so. And of course, we do in some instances. Blood transfusions or prescription glasses certainly involves this kind of individualized approach. But for a lot of the rest of what we do, we don't actually have the data to know how. That is what we aim to address with this program called All of Us. This is a historic longitudinal effort to gather data from 1 million or more people living in the United States. You've heard of Framingham, no doubt. We've all learned from Framingham a lot about how to prevent cardiovascular disease. Well, that was about 25,000 people focused on one disease and a very homogeneous group of people in Framingham, not far from here. This All of Us program will be 40 times larger than that. We'll focus on all diseases. We'll take advantage of all kinds of new opportunities, electronic health records, wearable sensors, complete genome sequences, and we'll also be a very diverse group of participants. We aim to have about 50% of the participants from racial and ethnic groups that are underrepresented so that we can learn about health disparities. This is going to mean nurturing relationships with participant partners in order to have them in a long-term follow-up study. This is not a one-shot deal. This is going to happen over decades. Be our partners. Get data back about themselves, including, if they want it, their complete genome sequences. We are sharing everything here, but also emphasizing diversity. And making a database that's accessible to any researcher who has a good idea about what can be learned from it with the database, having the individual information stripped of personal identifiers. This will, I think, empower a wide array of researchers to investigate things that previously we just have not had the resources to do. I mean, imagine this. You've got 1 million people who are ongoing participants who are pre-consented for recontact if you want to dial them up and say, hey, how about taking advantage of this next clinical trial that happens to be relevant to you? This can empower a lot of what we do. This is a platform on which many other studies can be built. We've actually been thinking about what kind of use cases would be available for this kind of study if it was already up there and going. I'll just try a couple out on you, but I bet you could come up with lots of your own. Why do some opioid-naive surgical patients exposed to opioids after surgery become persistent users while others do not? We don't know the answer to that. If we knew better, we might be able to better judge who we should be particularly careful about in terms of starting down this path. How about patients who have ductal carcinoma in situ, DCIS, and undergo partial mastectomy? What is going to distinguish those who recur from those who do not? Imagine you have 1 million people. You're going to have quite a lot of power for common conditions of this sort to be able to answer that question. Does surgery to relieve obstruction from BPH improve a patient's metabolic risk profile? There's some suggestion of that, but we don't really know. You're going to have that data. That's an easy one. You'll have lots of individuals who've gone through the surgery, and you'll be tracking their lab data over time. You'll know the answer. There's lots of others. You can think of probably many yourself. And again, if you want to take part in this, and I hope some of you will, you can join just by going to joinallofus.org and see what it takes. It's pretty simple, answering some questions, signing up to get a blood test done that will give some lab results and some DNA, and then agreeing to be followed over the course of time, providing ongoing access to electronic health records in the most secure database that you could imagine, which has already been set up and going. So is this some vast plan for the future that might roll out in 10 years? No. This was launched on May the 6th. In 7 cities around the country, but actually all over the place, and again, a very successful launch because, as of now, here we are in October, over 100,000 participants have already joined up, and so we're on a strong pathway over the next, let's say, 2 or 3 years to get to that 1 million cohort study. And think of all the ways that that's going to inform us, both about prevention and also about how to manage illness when it happens. As you can tell, I'm excited about this, and I think most people who've looked at it can see that this is going to be really quite transformative for much of what we need to know about medicine, and surgery is right in there too. So those are some of the things I wanted to put in front of you in what I admitted was going to be a bit of a potpourri, and you've now seen what I meant by that. But I hope you get a sense that this is a remarkable moment in medical research. For me, somebody who has been doing research in this field for about 35 years, we are seeing things happen now that I did not imagine could happen during my professional career, or maybe not ever. And the opportunity, particularly for young scientists to get engaged and to push this agenda forward, is both coming at a good time for resources and an amazing time as far as science. So I hope all of you interested in that will continue to come to NIH with your best ideas, and we will do the best we can, review them, put them through the process of peer review, and then identify what we can do with the funds we have to move the ball forward in so many ways that patients are waiting for. And that's why I think it is appropriate to call this the National Institutes of Hope. And hope, as Peter Levi said, in every sphere of life, is a privilege that attaches to action. I like that. It's one thing to say, well, I hope this disease gets some solution downstream. It's even better to say, and we have a plan of medical research that's going to lead to that hope becoming true. No action, no hope. I know the American College of Surgeons is all about action, and so are we at the NIH. Thank you all very much.